Hello, listeners, and welcome to today's podcast, where we invite our guests to bear all and spill the tea. Today's Spill the Tea podcast is brought to you by me, Maddox Hughes, and my co-host, Shannon Cairns. From All Saints Academy, we are pleased to introduce Tom Webster and Molly Dibkin from Barakara School. Joining us, we have the pleasure of welcoming today's guests, who has become somewhat of a legend in the rowing world.
Today, we are really excited to get the chance to catch up with great British athlete, World University Championship gold medalist, European Junior Championship silver medalist, World Champion silver medalist, head of the Charles Regatta winner, and world record holder by 26 seconds, and Oxford versus Cambridge boat race winner, Morgan Bainham-Williams.
Well, that's a lot of words. Morgan is making a stand for the women in the sport, and we are honoured to have her here with us today. Welcome, Morgan.
Thank you very much for having me.
Morgan, in a sporting world that is sometimes viewed as a male's world, what is it like being a female athlete, and do you ever find that you are treated differently?
I think in rowing it's starting to become fairly equal between men and women, and certainly in terms of the funding support that athletes receive, it's the same. So actually it's not, there's not that kind of gender disparity that there is in other sports. I think as well, because it's done at club level, so within local towns, you get boys and girls that take it up when they're younger. The same thing kind of happens at private schools as well, or any schools that have got rowing, so it's on the curriculum and both boys and girls will do it. And I think in terms of being treated differently, it's not necessarily a problem I've had, because coxes can cox men and women, whether you're male or female. And that's the case up until, or it was the case up until you were an international athlete, and then it was just same sex, but actually that rule has changed as well. So it's not such a problem, or there's not as much of a gap.
Quite interesting. To date, what is the best or most memorable moment in your rowing career so far, and why?
I'd probably pick out two standout memories. So the first one would be it was the morning of the boat race, and we do a paddle, like a row, before we actually do the race. And we come into land, and there was a press boat there, and I'd gone to step into the river to get out the boat, and I got my foot caught underneath the fin. And the fin is worth thousands of pounds, because it's carbon fibre, and it's what I would use to steer the boat in the race. And I got my foot caught on it, and I was like, right, either I'm going to rip the fin off with my foot, or I'm just going to have to go with the boat. So I ended up falling into the river on the morning of the race. And I remember texting my sister. I looked at my phone and she was like, good luck today. Like, I'm sure you'll be great. And I was like, I've just fallen in, full stop. And that was the race. That was the race morning itself. And then probably, you know, doing the boat race was a very, very memorable, standout part of my career so far. Never do you sit on the start line with just one other boat. There's a helicopter overhead. There's thousands of people on the bank, thousands of people watching it on the TV, and there's a lot of pressure there, but also to be able to win that race is pretty special.
That sounds really cool. Can you talk to us about that memorable boat race where the commentators didn't really understand what you were doing?
Yeah, so in 2016, I raced for Oxford in the women's boat race, and we knew on that day the weather was going to be really bad. So it was going to be wind against stream, and that meant that there would be white horses and it'd be really, really wavy. So white horses are where the water comes up so high that it kind of folds over and it creates a lot of wash. And actually, in a rowing boat, that's quite problematic because they can take on board a lot of water. And we'd had a conversation before we went out to race, and our coach had said, you know, no matter what the conditions, they're going to be our perfect boat race conditions. And that was something that really stuck with us down that track. So we started off, and the boat race is 6.8 kilometres long, so it's quite a long time. And we got about 2 kilometres in, and the water was okay, it wasn't too bad, we were up, we were leading by about a length, maybe 2 lengths, and as we took a very tight turn around to Surrey after coming through Hammersmith Bridge, so it's a really bendy race, we obviously changed direction, and so the wind hit us. And that wind against stream meant that the waves were really, really big. They were coming over top of the athletes' heads, it was coming over the side of the boat, we're filling up with water, and we've got pumps on board. And my job in the coxswain's seat is not only to be the tactician, not only to tell them the race plan, to steer, but also I have to work the pumps. I turn them on and turn them off, and turn the pumps on, and the pumps aren't getting the water out fast enough for how much water's coming in, and it's unbelievably heavy. It's like the athletes are having to leg press 150, 200 kilos every single stroke. And I'm just thinking, God, this is awful. We had better connected length. So if you row a long stroke and you drive the boat for a long time, that's advantageous in boat speed. And I knew that that was better in our boat than it was in the Cambridge boat. But what made a big difference for us is I practiced this part of the course where you take the turn and it swings one way and then it starts to turn out another. And so you kind of move across towards the Middlesex side. And as I turned and took this part of the course, one of the athletes in my crew was like, Morgan, Cambridge. So I turned around. I was like, hang on a minute, like Cambridge are cutting the corner. Like, what's going on there? And in the Burrows, you try to steer the boat in the deepest channels because that's where the water runs fastest. And on the inside of a turn is not where the fastest water is. The fastest water is on the outside of a bend. And so I'm like, well, hold on, I'm on the outside of a bend here. Cambridge are on the inside of a bend. All of a sudden, they're traveling significantly faster than I am. And they've caught us up by about a length. And I'm like, what's going on? And within about half a second, I know that the wind is overpowering the stream. And so sitting in the deepest channel with waves coming over the side will not win us the boat race. So that traditional line that has been developed and talked about over many, many years was useless. And so I remember having a conversation with the boat race umpire on the Monday before the race, and he said, you know, the only rules in the boat race really are you go, when they say go, you have to go through the centre arch of the bridge and then you cross the finish line. You can steer where you want to steer. This traditional line is just something that people have come up with, and it's like an old boys' unspoken agreement that that is where you steer. If you don't steer, then you're doing it wrong, if you're in a different place to that. And my view on it was, well, I want to win. So if I got out of the fastest flying water, there wouldn't be as much resistance of wind against stream, so I tucked myself in the bank and cut back across, and meanwhile the commentators are kicking off, but I've got no idea this is going on. I'm just focused on the stroke we're on and winning the race. And as soon as I got into that, the kind of shallower water, the conditions were way better. So Cambridge are stuck to my right, they're stuck in the waves, they've got this water coming over the side and they're filling up and filling up and filling up, and essentially I'm in a position to hold their boat underwater because I'm not filling up with water. We're gaining speed, we're moving away, and they're still stuck in those waves. And the final decision I made was to cut right across, go to the complete other side of the river, and it's called the inshore zone, and that's kind of the shallowest channel, so there's no stream there, and so it's dead water, but actually it was flat as a pancake. So we cut straight across, and I didn't know until after the race, the commentary were like, this is not going to pay off. You know, what is she doing? Where is she going? And we went right up the bank. It was really flat. Pumps kicked in. Water's clearing out of the 8. We're gaining speed. And the only thing left that I had to do was steer back out and go through the centre of the arch. And by the time I looked behind to see where Cambridge are, well, we're 24 lengths ahead. They're sinking. We've won the boat race. And that was that.
That's really clever. It would prove the commentators wrong. So when you are successful and as you start to build up a name for yourself, you start to get interviewed more and more. What is the worst thing that somebody has asked you in an interview?
I actually got asked in part of the boat race media prep if I felt hindered for going to a state school, not a private school. And I joked around with them a little bit and I was like, should we take this outside? And then I was like, no, you know, I'm here. I'm at Oxford. I've got an undergraduate degree from Oxford Brookes, and now I'm studying for a postgraduate degree at the University of Oxford. And actually, no, I don't feel hindered. It doesn't matter where you're from or what school you go to. What matters is what you believe you can do and the work you're willing to put into it.
Thank you very much. What motivated you to improve so rapidly in your sport when you were a kid?
I think I just really enjoyed it. It's so much fun being part of a team and getting the most out of people around you, and actually you're learning things when you don't even realise it, and you can take those things not only into the sport itself but everyday life and school. And I was just having a lot of fun, and I still do it now because I love the sport itself. I'm not doing it for, you know, a public profile or anything like that. I'm doing it because I really, really love rowing.
Cheers for that. How do you prepare for, like, big races?
So a lot of what you do when you race is exactly the same as what you do when you're training. So the preparation happens day in, day out. And actually, to put together a winning performance, you do that in the training in the lead up to it. On the day, you essentially just kind of turn up and collect that medal. Yes, you have to perform, but because of the work that you've done, that's where the result comes from. So when we get out there and we race on the day, we've rehearsed again and again and again, you know, our race plan, like training really hard, how we're going to move in the boat, the certain things I'm going to say. And so that's where it all comes from. It's preparation over a series of days and months that comes together and gets you ready for the event itself.
That's really interesting. What was the worst moment in your sporting career, and what did you learn from it?
When I was first starting out, I learnt to row first as an actual rower rather than a cox. And I would have been maybe about 13, 14 at the time. And I was like, please, 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 like, put me in. I promise I can do it. I promise I can do it. Like, put me in for this race. Let me cox it. And the coach was like, I'm not sure. And this is in my home rowing club in Ross and Wye. And then the coach was like, okay, all right, I'll put you in. So it's only 750 metres. It's not a serious race. It's just like a little home regatta. But for the club itself, it was probably one of the top crews that they were putting out. And I was like, yeah, I can definitely cox this. I can do this. So we got off from the start. It was pretty good. And then I just remember the stroke seat throwing up on me, and I got it in my eyes. And then I'm like, ah, my eyes! And I can't see where we're going. So I take my hands off the rudders, and then I'm not steering. And then we veer into the other crew and get disqualified. So I started my career really well. really set the tone nice and early, you know?
Quite interesting. It takes an awful lot of discipline and hugely positive mindset to even start to think about aiming for the Olympics. What advice do you have for some of our listeners wanting to aim high and try and make it in the sporting industry?
I think you've really got to enjoy what you're doing, and a lot of it comes from self-belief. You're not going to make these massive leaps overnight. Actually, it's about the daily grind and enjoying the training and enjoying the little things that you're doing day to day. That's what makes the difference. It's an accumulation of small things that come together to make that big step. And I think just if you're passionate about something, that's what drives you. If you've got the passion, then you're going to put those extra hours in, you're going to enjoy what you're doing, you're going to inspire things from other people around you, and that will be the standout difference between you and somebody else.
Yeah, I agree with that. Simple question, how can I get into rowing, and what do you need to get into it?
I think there's loads of local clubs around in towns, and just having a look on their website and seeing if they've got any taster days or little training camps or Easter camps or things like that, and just going along to those. And really, you don't need anything, you just need to turn up in some clothes that you might wear for PE or something like that, depending on the weather, and they'll do the rest. You know, the clubs have got the equipment, you just have to be willing to show up, really.
You're an inspiration to many, but what's the one thing that you've done to try and inspire others? Can you give us an example?
So in a rowing specific context, in 2015 I was racing at the under 23 World Championships, and we're in the final, and we were maybe 1250 metres in, and the race is 2000 metres long, so we've got about 750 metres left to go. And in the eight, you want to be, you know, top two at that point in time, because you've left it pretty late. And we were coming last. And I was like, oh, like, what are we going to do? You know, I've not come all this way to not win a medal. And this is a bit dire. And so, I don't know, I just started singing the national anthem. And the turn of speed in the crew was absolutely ridiculous. And we came away with a bronze medal.
That's incredible.
Thank you for that. World Rowing have updated their guidelines, meaning women can now cox a male crew. Similarly to this, the women's boat race is now finally being treated as equal as the men's boat race. Why is it taking so long for women's sports to get the same prestige as men's sport?
I would say it's because of the time that women have been involved in sport. So historically, men were participating in rowing much earlier than women. And so for, say, the women's boat race, you didn't have women's crews racing over the same distance, or it wasn't necessarily a race on who's fastest. It was about who looked the best, you know, who had the best kind of rowing style or something like that. And there was this kind of belief across different sports that women didn't have the physiological capacity to compete, whether that was because their bodies couldn't handle it or it was dangerous to them, or these kind of misunderstandings, misconceptions. And it's the same in endurance events like marathon running. Women weren't allowed to run the marathon because they didn't think they could make it. They thought it would be really detrimental to their health. And actually, there are scientific studies that show women are significantly better endurance athletes than men. And if you look at the times for endurance runners, the gap between men and women is actually closer than in other sports. So a lot of it is down to time in the sport. And with history in an event comes prestige and money, and you've got, you know, your old alumni societies, and they provide money and support to boat clubs, to teams, and that all encourages or facilitates the development of a program. And so actually, because women's rowing hasn't been around for as long, they're playing catch up. But actually, there's a big driving force just worldwide in all sports to actually equalize what we're doing. And I think there's something called Title IX in America for collegiate sport, where women's sport, so not specifically rowing, but women's sport had to be given the same amount of money as men's sport at their collegiate teams. So that's their university teams over there, and sport is highly commercialised, and that's completely revolutionised the way women's sport is perceived over there. And rowing's been very lucky that actually it was one of the sports that was given a lot of money for women's sport, and so that's accelerated the performance standards for women worldwide, because they get in athletes from all over the world on scholarships, and these scholarships are hundreds of thousands of pounds. It's pretty crazy.
That's really interesting. Thanks for that. Now, we wouldn't really be spilling the tea properly if we didn't ask you a few gritty questions at the end to find out the stuff that our listeners really want to know. At the end of all our podcasts, we're asking you our final hashtag #33 questions to really juice things up for our listeners. Our guests haven't been sent these final 33 questions, so now is our chance to really get to know them. First up, what is the most outrageous thing you've ever seen in your career so far?
I think this is a really interesting question, because for me, it becomes a part of daily life. Every day, I train 6 days a week, and we get up and we do 3 sessions, and we start 7 a.m, we finish about 3 o'clock, and we just keep going, and we do these things, and we have races, and that's all just part of it. But actually, for an outsider, something like when you get in a rowing boat and you're in there for 2 hours, 2.5 hours, if you go to a race, you might be in there for 3 hours, 4 hours. And the athletes are really hydrated, so they need to go to the toilet. And a lot of the time, if you're just walking up the bank, you'll see them like hanging over the side of the boat, like balancing over the rigger, and they've got trousers around their ankles. And I think as a spectator or like an onlooker, you're just like, what's going on there? But for us, that's just normal day, or they're squatting in their footwell, and that seems pretty normal. But actually, that's not normal, is it? To see that on the river.
Yeah, it sounds disgusting. So, looking back on your life, if you had to thank one person, whether you know them or not, that is at the centre of everything that you've done and that is your ultimate inspiration, who is that and why?
I think this is tricky, because I have received so much support from my family. I feel like that's an obvious one to say. But so my mum's an absolute rowing nerd. You know, she knows things about the Olympic team before I do. And I'm like, well, hang on, I'm training with them. Like, how do you know this? And that really makes a difference in what you're doing, because you know that the support is there, and she's so wholeheartedly invested in what I'm doing. And I think there's another thing for me is when I went to Oxford, I went to Oxford specifically to work with a women's program, and that was seen as quite an unorthodox thing to do, because it's all about the men's boat race, you know, that's where the big money is, and that's why people put the TV on, because they're there to watch the boat race, not the men's boat race or the women's boat race. But I went because I wanted to work with their coach, and it was a woman called Christine Wilson, and I'd heard she was a hard taskmaster, but I honestly had no idea. And in that year, it completely transformed me, not only as an athlete, but also as a person. And I learned lessons, and I now am capable of doing things that I just did not know I was capable of. But it was single-handedly the hardest year of my life, but also at the same time, you know, one of the best. And I think a lot of how I conduct myself in both the working environment, but also just like normal world, is down to a lot of what she taught me. And I think that's really important that we've got role models like that, especially female role models.
What is the worst piece of advice that you've ever been given?
So this is something that I now say a lot, and it's kind of like backhandedly laughing about the advice that I was given. But someone said to me, "It'll be all right, unless it's not." And I think when you hear that, you're just like, oh, yeah, right, okay. So now that's something that I'll say in everyday life, you know, it'll be a bit tricky, or someone's having a struggle, I'll be like, oh, it'll be all right, unless it's not.
So, Morgan, you've been an absolute star, and thank you for spilling the tea with us here at All Saints Academy.
This podcast is brought to you by the Cheltenham Educational Partnership, and it's been fantastic to work alongside our partner secondary schools to get to know our surrounding professionals even more.
Tune in next week for our Eco Special, where we are joined by Climate Emergency Programme Officer Laura Tapping and Climate Emergency Project Supporter Alexandra Wells.
Thanks for listening, and we can't wait for next week, where, as usual, we promise to
spill the tea.
Spill the, spill the, spill the tea. Spill the, spill the, spill the tea.
Today's Spill the Tea podcast was brought to you by the Cheltenham Educational Partnership.